Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Rebellious CEO, 12 Leaders Who Did It Right, by Ralph Nader, narrated by Joe Barrett. Introduction. This book is an easy listen for business students, current and future business leaders, and for a discouraged citizenry. During 6 decades of confronting CEOs in many different industries and lines of commerce, I have had, from time to time, one-on-one meetings with the heads of corporations. Some of these meetings were desirable, others were necessary. In some of these encounters, I found a few CEOs to be wonders of values and performance. These meetings turned out to be impressive, educational, and even encouraging concerning the state of what other CEOs could emulate. This book, the result of these encounters, selects 12 CEOs who exceeded my expectations. These are people whom I got to know and grew to admire. All but 3 have passed on. Their work generated forces that have made our economy better than it would have been. Whether their practices and accompanying wisdom continue to reverberate and resonate outside of their immediate circles is hard to say. Their lives and work provide examples that can benefit the present and future if more people, more students, are able to learn about these leaders and examine how they overcame their challenges to deal with the human beings whose lives impacted or were impacted by them. I met many other CEOs at various events, conferences, social gatherings, and even depositions. I found most of them to be prisoners on temporary leave from their top-down authoritarian corporations. In more informal settings, they spoke as less fettered human beings. Some cases in point. Paul Austin, a fellow Harvard Law alumnus and CEO of Coca-Cola, advised on a walk to lunch that, contrary to popular lore, large, powerful corporations were, if put under certain pressures, fragile and vulnerable. I countered by asking him why he used his obvious talents in the service of a company that sold a non-nutritious, sugary drink all over the world based on a secret formula locked somewhere in a safe in Atlanta, Georgia. He replied, "I don't see anything wrong with selling a refreshing drink." Here's another instance of that informality. The CEO of Armco Steel once told me he took his board of directors on a sensitivity trip deep into a coal mine that the company owned. "They didn't want to stay there very long," he said. When they emerged above, he heard them mutter that they would never again say coal miners were overpaid. When we had these exchanges, neither of these gentlemen was accompanied by advisors, assistants, or flacks. Each spoke candidly. Unfortunately, such relative openness was not often on display when they were operating in their normal realm, whether in an executive suite or shareholders' meeting. One reason for my choice of the people profiled here is that each displayed forthright candor, competence, and a recognition of the complexities of society that shape the bottom line. I want to say at the outset that if I didn't want to keep this book relatively short, other CEOs who were productively engaging in the community could have been added, whether, depending on the scope of their interventions, that be community writ large or small. I might have chosen Peter B. Lewis, CEO of Progressive Insurance Company, who performed in exemplary ways as a philanthropist. He built the tiny company started by his father into the 3rd largest auto insurance company in America. He was the largest contributor to the ACLU, funded progressive think tanks, and was one of a few billionaires, along with George Soros, to openly oppose wars of empire and press for peaceful diplomacy as a solution to global conflicts. He was my classmate at Princeton, where I remembered him as almost shy. Nothing like the iconoclastic, bold, flamboyant head of his insurance company, or the daring promoter of architectural and artistic projects that he became. It took just one lunch with Peter for me to convince him to equip Progressive's large fleet of company cars with airbags. Only Travelers Insurance Company did this earlier, and dramatically, it was because of an airbag that saved an employee's life in a collision with a truck. Peter was a believer in insurance companies fostering loss prevention, or safer products and conditions. At my urging, Peter led Progressive to become the first auto insurance company to give their customers comparison rates so they could price Progressive policies in relation to those of their top competitors, such as Allstate and State Farm. This was done even though in some localities, Progressive might not come in first. When I informed him about my plan to establish the first tort museum in the world, the American Museum of Tort Law, in Winsted, Connecticut, he blurted a pithy description of what the place was all about when he exclaimed, "Tort law is quality control for the insurance industry." However, he declined to become one of its numerous founders. Peter took the giving pledge, promising to give away at least half of his fortune to good causes during his lifetime. Unfortunately for the many civic charities he was contributing to, and for those on the drawing board, Peter died from a heart attack on November 23, 2013, at age 80. A many-splendored free spirit with a keen appreciation for marijuana, which he first used as a pain reliever after part of his leg was amputated in 1998, he left many who met him with off-the-wall stories about his thoughts on grass and other matters. He once told me that when Princeton investigated him before nominating him to its board of trustees, he gave Princeton more than $200 million over the years, their report called him a functional pothead. Peter, like many of the best CEOs, understood that working to mitigate societal problems through his advocacy, philanthropy, and style of corporate leadership would benefit the world and his company. In Joel McCower's optimistic book from the 1990s, Beyond the Bottom Line, Putting Social Responsibility to Work for Your Business and the World, he offers numerous examples of socially sensitive companies: StrideRight, Levi Strauss, South Shore Bank, Ben & Jerry's, Stonefield Farms, Just Desserts Bakery, and others, led by progressive doers and thinkers. Some of these firms had elaborate, enlightened mission statements. All believed that a wider arc for their company made their firm, workers, and suppliers more productive and happier, leading to more satisfied customers and a more profitable bottom line. McCower said such a corporate culture, one that took a wider perspective on civic culture and the environment, was reaping the benefits of benevolence. However, if one looks with less rose-tinted glasses than the ones McCower wore, it's noticeable that some of his snapshots were of large divisions of companies, like Freddie Mac or Reebok International, divisions that were doing something commendable, while the rest of the company operated in conventional, profit-seeking ways, with all the liabilities that accompany such a narrow focus. Others that he justly praises went out of business or merged with larger corporations and lost much of their identity. Enthusiastic forecasts of a growing trend of corporate civic consciousness put forward by progressive business groups, such as Social Venture Network or Business for Social Responsibility, did not materialize as hoped. Instead, we sometimes saw a contrary trend over the last few years. Indeed, companies emerging from Silicon Valley, or those that are part of the gig economy, often took irresponsible steps backward. While the standbys, those companies that have always stood against a strong civic culture, such as banks and other giant financial intermediaries, and the venerable, ever more entrenched military-industrial complex, persist. Among new corporate threats are the triad of new technologies, described in Bill Joy's landmark Wired magazine article from 2000, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. He warned of the looming risks from artificial intelligence, biotechnology, and nanotechnology, which are proceeding full speed ahead, with no legal or ethical frameworks to restrain them. Rarely has such a portentous forecast been more on target and less heeded once its immediate shock value wore off, swept aside by recklessness or the headlong rush for more of the latest sensation and profits. And that meant more corporate science and technology driven by ever narrower monetized minds, regardless of consequences. In contradistinction to the leaders at the head of this new wave of reaction, the chief executives portrayed in this book provide fertile and fascinating materials for study. They made ethical choices to promote civic culture and the natural environment. Self-chosen behaviors not required by law nor industry practice or custom. They challenged stereotypes slapped on their line of commerce, stereotypes which saw them as made up solely of companies that put the bottom line above all. They chose higher, ethical behavior, declining to avail themselves of the routine excuses about duty to shareholders, competitive riskiness, government regulation, or other pretexts most executives employ for explaining why they are not making beneficial changes. They were trailblazers whose own conduct and that of their companies shaped distinctive pathways toward excellence. The executives profiled here stood against the gray crowd. They were all unique individuals, so meeting them could understandably lead one to conclude that they were all completely different in personality and style. Even so, they shared an astonishingly uniform set of characteristics. The only one of these executives also depicted in Macaur's upbeat treatment was Anita Roddick, founder of The Body Shop. That was his choice, even though 9 of the 12 of my selected CEOs were in full operation at that time. Curiously, though confident and upbeat, they did not, as Macaur did, extrapolate their achievements as part of an upward, unstoppable trend. They shared a tough-minded pessimism. They were too realistic in their appraisal of the corporate resistance to change, no matter how much their forays into social responsiveness and internal company humanity were proven to benefit sales and profits. Other innovators in the mid-90s, the time Macaur was writing his book, waxed euphorically about the future in the same way Macaur did. As an example, Ben Cohen, the upbeat ice cream magnate, said that if business was smart, it had better jump on the progressive bandwagon because altruism was good for business and staying competitive. From a glance at today's business climate, you can see how few that bandwagon picked up. Paul Fireman, CEO of Reebok International, was equally euphoric, saying about the same time, "I believe we're on the verge of what might be a genuine shift in our nation's priorities, and official end to the me and greed decade. We now know that the conditions of our business cannot be separated from the conditions of the society in which we operate." Another mistaken prediction. For most companies, the only difference in their control of society's institutions is that now companies have changed to reflect greater diversity in their hiring and promotions. Otherwise, their baleful influence continues in force, diversity notwithstanding. The 12's similarities were striking. But on second glance, you can see these character traits were functional prerequisites for getting things done their way. Another trait was that they marched to their own drums. They couldn't care less what people thought of them. Restless Bob Townsend, who ran Avis through a turnaround, among other executive tasks, made his writing, speaking, and consulting career out of jolting contrarian thinking. Gino Paolucci, who started many companies, mostly in the food and packaging business, discovered that to win the sale from his position as an underdog, he had to do brazen things as an upstart. They all did the improbable. Ray Anderson had to reinvent his large carpet tile company, Interface, from the bottom up to make it environmentally responsive. John Bogle reinvented his industry by pioneering the low-fee Vanguard Group as a mutual company, not a stock company. It is the message of Paul Hawken, the environmentalist and entrepreneur, who goes around the world preaching the gospel of reinvention and showing corporations how they must somersault their operations to achieve sustainability before time runs out for the planet. Another commonality among these leaders? They insisted on treating their workers and customers well. All CEOs mouth that they are committed to their workers and customers, but it seldom goes beyond lip service. These CEOs meant it and delivered. Herb Kelleher, CEO of Southwest Airlines, fostered a family-caring culture in a firm that employs 66,000 people. His personal touch included reaching out to its workers to help them get through turmoil and tragedy. Employees I have talked to, I was a frequent flyer on this airline, tell me the caring standard of management toward workers is almost too good to be true. Kelleher put the well-being of workers first, even before that of customers, and he explained why. As for addressing their customers in a way that goes beyond expectations, speak to Yvon Chouinard's Patagonia customers, and you'll see what I mean. Idealistic as all these CEOs are, and no matter how many different good causes they and their companies pursued, they shared another trait. All these CEOs insisted that nothing would be possible if they didn't pay attention to profits. Thus, they were heedful of the details of their businesses. Anita Roddick spared no effort in designing the body shop stores for an authentic, warm atmosphere while posting bold signs urging actions for justice. She was an environmentally aware person who made clear to her environmentally conscious customers that she was detail-minded in relation to ecological concerns, which ran from her choice of suppliers in tropical forests to the reuse of bottles for the store's sales. While restaurateur Andy Shalal, as he continued his political activism, personally reviewed menus to make sure they were hitting his customers' taste buds. He created the artwork on his restaurant walls to ensure a positive atmosphere and made sure there was no censorship at his attached bookstores and public event rooms, so the bookstore and event patrons got a full perspective. Every Saturday, Bernard Rappaport of American Income Life Insurance Company telephoned his general agents one after the other for brief chats about the state of business. However, none of them avoided speaking out against injustices for fear it would offend customers, cause political retaliation, or hurt the bottom line. They refused to censor their political views. They named the political candidates they supported without worrying that they might lose sales. Saul Price, the Jewish founder of Price Club, condemned the functioning of grand juries and funded Palestinian job training and other charitable activities to the consternation of some of his Jewish business colleagues. Rappaport also championed labor unions as the CEO of a life insurance company. This stance was unheard of at the time in this staid, reactionary, non-unionized industry. Gordon Sherman of Midas Muffler offended Chicago's business upper crust with his open support of tough advocates who were working to rein in their chronic abuses. I rarely heard any of them whine about government over-regulation. For one thing, they went beyond the regulations, doing more for environmental and civic betterment than was required by law, especially in the case of Patagonia and Interface. For another, they realized that corporations deserved to be regulated or broken up, given what most corporations were not doing about corruption and pollution, among other abuses. This is why Gino Paolucci took those who wronged him to court, suing in all directions as one way to protest dishonest peers. Most of them, too, were founders. They had control and exerted it to get things done, to get the best out of people, to give their company meaning and be concerned with issues beyond maximizing the company's profits and personal wealth. Kelleher was for years by far the lowest compensated executive among big airlines, even though he was running the country's most profitable airline. He was paid less than $1 million a year. But he retired a wealthy man because Southwest's stock greatly appreciated during his tenure. The company's wealth was spread around. Everyone at Southwest was awarded shares, a payback for their commitment and helpfulness. John Bogle of Vanguard made such priorities specific in his remarkable book, Enough, where he chastised fellow executives who made amassing money their number one goal. As founders, the 12 could imprint on their firms their own special character, personality, and vision, developing an expanding structure that they intimately shaped. Were they to have inherited a bureaucratic company, it would have been far more difficult to produce such accomplishments. Most of the CEOs in this book are white men. Unfortunately, gender and racial equality in the corporate suites increases at a glacial pace. In 2021, 86% of Fortune 500 CEOs were white men. Only 1% of Fortune 500 CEOs were African Americans. In January 2023, the percentage of women CEOs at Fortune 500 companies hit 10%. Most of these 12 had stable families and showed care and compassion in their daily lives. They were generous with time and money toward others whom they encountered, whether in their family circles, their businesses, or their outside philanthropy. They set examples for their employees. They were hands-on people who were good at foreseeing and forestalling situations that might destabilize or harm their workforce. Kelleher never laid off a single worker in the boom-and-bust airline industry. This is not to say they never made wrong decisions or took the wrong track. Some made mistakes that shortened their tenures as controlling CEOs. Anita and Gordon Roddick were persuaded that going public would provide more resources to expand and help them do more of their remarkable groundbreaking philanthropy and democratic institution building. It didn't work out. They lost control of their company. This cut short their exponential contributions to world betterment. This was particularly tragic because Anita, among all those profiled here, had the most all-encompassing grasp of how to turn the world around and shift power from the few to the many. She expounded her views in her four books, which are marvels of readable, visual, personal, no-holds-barred challenges to the present exploitations and environmental degradation, while clear-sightedly offering ways to democratize the world and fulfill human possibilities. In another tragic case, Gordon Sherman challenged his angry, conservative father for control of Midas Muffler, which Gordon took from the tiny firm of his father's in Chicago to a company with hundreds of franchises around the world. He lost the shareholder struggle and was pushed out just when his momentum and the philanthropic Midas Foundation were getting underway in a peerless, bold fashion. None of the CEOs profiled were interested in turning their companies into conglomerates, nor in themselves becoming preachers. As to conglomeration, for one thing, they knew how difficult it would be to manage such corporate sprawl. It would dilute the high standards of their original business enterprises. When asked to franchise his restaurants, Andy Shalal shrugged his shoulders and said he doubts anyone could replicate his personal hybrid model. Only modestly were they interested in spreading their business gospel. They preferred to speak through their actions, though Ray Anderson, an exception, made hundreds of speeches in which he hammered home in technological detail the dire necessity of making sustainability the number one priority for business. He persuaded upper management and Walmart to reduce their excessive packaging and therefore reduce their costs. But aside from Anderson, the group of CEOs pretty much stuck to their tasks. They did not fear competition because their way of competing was so far ahead of their industry peers. Let's turn the page on that destructive way of living and doing business conducted by today's corporate chiefs and look to the example outlined by these exemplars. I'm going to divide them into two classes. Despite the commonalities I pointed out, I still see a division, one which will structure this book. Some are visionaries, such as Anita Roddick with her environmental consciousness, or Yvon Chouinard with his love for the wild, who had a crystal-clear vision of the way the world should be moving. They poured all their energy into their visions. Others are mavericks. These are CEOs who were just all-around humanists. They didn't move in tune to a burning vision, but simply acted in solidarity with the people and progressively to solve the problems that obstructed their paths. Here I place Gino Paolucci, who, when he saw a mining company was illegally dumping in his own backyard, fought hard to stop it in its tracks. Also of this genre was Saul Price, who worked hard to improve educational and employment opportunities in his home base of San Diego, California. The distinction I am making is a differentiation, not a judgment, for each set of leaders in their own way gave us a sense of what might have been and what still could be if business were rigorously framed as a process that was not only about making money and selling things, but about reducing damage and improving our social and natural world. 1. John Bogle, founder of the Vanguard Group. Surprising as it may seem to most people, Americans are the greatest owners of wealth, not the 1% of the super rich who own so much of the private wealth. What I'm referring to are such massive assets as the public lands, which together with adjacent offshore seabed territory constitute 1/3 of the United States, the public airwaves, trillions of dollars in pension and mutual funds, and least recognized, trillions of dollars in government research and development given away to build the major industries of our economy, including biotech, computer, internet, drug, aerospace, and nanotech companies, and many other enterprises. The problem is that people do not control what they own. Corporations do, either directly or through their dominating influence over such government agencies as the Federal Communications Commission and the Departments of Agriculture, Interior, Defense, and Commerce. No one has recognized this difference between ownership and control better than John C. Bogle, best known for founding the giant Vanguard Group, with over $7 trillion in assets, and pioneering low-cost, low-fee investing with mutual funds and stock market index funds. I wanted to invite Bogle to participate in an event at DAR Constitution Hall in D.C. devoted to Breaking Through Power, a Historic Civic Mobilization. So I put in a call to Mr. Bogle to invite him to be our keynote speaker on September 27, 2016, about fiduciary duties as if shareholders mattered. His tone was friendly but weary. He was in great demand by people hungry for the truth at various levels about corporate greed, the ripping off of investors, especially individuals, and the excessive power of the Wall Street crowd. Jack, as he insisted on being called, was a big thinker and a relentless doer, a man whose integrity and steadiness contrasted with fast-talking speculators with fully monetized minds. Years earlier, admiring investors calling themselves Bogleheads combined to form clubs around the country. Everyone wanted a piece of Jack, and now, in his late 80s, I was asking for half a day of his time. He sighed and said that he might be able to shift a meeting that day and come down from Pennsylvania. He did, and spoke before a rapt audience. In 1951, he wrote his Princeton undergraduate thesis on this newfangled thing called a mutual fund. He was prophetic, and, like most innovators, he was ahead of his time and therefore mocked or dismissed. Those were the days of high fixed commissions and few required disclosures about companies' financial conditions. The brokerage industry was a uniform, smug fortress against change and diverse offerings for investors. It's hard to imagine what Jack Bogle had to endure and overcome as he threw himself into a life and career with an almost missionary zeal. He wrote 10 books, ran a fast-evolving business, crossed swords with the state and already established investment industry that often spread disinformation about him, raised 6 children with his wife, and educated himself in the classics, history, and poetry, all while maintaining a sense of humor. He possessed a level of generosity and understanding of people and places that amazed his friends. He suffered his first heart attack in 1960 when he was 30, and other heart attacks followed until he received a heart transplant at age 66 in 1996. When he was 37 years old, his doctor urged him to retire, given his perilous condition. Jack simply thanked him and found another physician. Aaron Arvidland and Art Carey of the Philadelphia Inquirer said after his passing at age 89 in January 2019 that he displayed the energy of men half his age, and his pace and ambition were the more remarkable because of his lifelong battle with heart disease, the result of a congenital defect that affected the heart's electrical current. He just had to believe that he loved what he was doing so much that mortal risk was never high on his radar screen. He resumed playing squash and tennis after his transplant, a testimony to psychosomatic triumph, perhaps. On his passing, Vanguard Chief Executive Officer Tim Buckley said that Jack Bogle made an impact not only on the entire investment industry, but more importantly, on the lives of countless individuals saving for their futures or their children's futures. He democratized and simplified investing and made it affordable for the average American. He was the original industry disruptor, said Peter G. Fitzgerald, a former Republican U.S. Senator from Illinois. Author and investment manager William Bernstein said, Jack could have been a multibillionaire on par with Gates and Buffett. Instead, he turned his company into one owned by its mutual funds, and in turn their investors, to provide its customers the lowest price. He basically chose to forego an enormous fortune to do something right for millions of people. I don't know any other story like it in American business history. At his death, Bogle's fortune was estimated to be $80 million, while his counterparts at higher fee Fidelity are worth billions. Rick Stengel, former managing editor of Time, worked with Bogle, who then was the chair of the National Constitution Center's board, and saw a different side of the man. He was like the last honorable man, a complete straight shooter.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?